quite often a chemically dependent person, stops going to church, can get fired from 1, 2, 3, 4 jobs, stops being involved in hobbies and activities that they were previously. And so this pretty much shrivels up. And the significant, meaningful love relationship shifts down to the mood-altering chemical. A trust relationship is established. This becomes the beloved. This is what the person seeks after, anticipates, looks forward to. And quite often the reason people misuse drugs is because Mac never disappoints the person. Mac is always there. It always works. And so a very basic, significant love relationship develops between the person and the mood-altering chemical, and becomes more important than the spouse or the family or the boss or the pastor. Becomes more important than hobbies and activities and work. The only thing that counts is to keep this relationship going. And this person will lie, get into a lot of defenses to maintain that relationship. I think to understand chemical dependency or dependencies of any sort, it's important to realize it's a relationship issue. You can have sick, unhealthy relationships person to person. If you just have one relationship and you exclude everybody else out of your life, that can become sick and unhealthy, right? Or if the most important relationship is with your car, and you spend hours and hours with your car, you don't come in to eat with a family or a hobby, you can develop unhealthy dependencies in all three of these areas. It's just today and yesterday and a little bit tomorrow we're going to focus on the chemical, because that's so pervasive and fatal in this country. It's growing, and it's a concern on a lot of people's minds, parents with the children and also adults, the spouse or friend. Okay, any questions? Do you all understand this basic point that I was trying to make yesterday? Chemical dependency is a sick, unhealthy relationship with mood-altering chemicals, with MAC, in anticipation of a rewarding experience. You look forward to that, to being with your beloved. Have any of you ever been to Cloquet, Minnesota?
Yes.
Have you seen Tilly's Bar? There's a bar there called Tilly's Bar, and on the outside wall, there's a saying. It says, if you're feeling blue and got nothing to do, stop in at Tilly's and have a few. And it captures really nicely, I think, this whole relationship thing. You know, if you got nothing to do, if you're by yourself, you aren't with people, you're feeling kind of blue, come on in and have a few. Make you feel better. Okay? Okay. Now, we've all done work where we haven't had the proper tools, and that can be very frustrating. And when talking about chemical dependency, and I realize chemical dependency is a phrase that grew out of Minnesota, and some people aren't really sure what I'm talking about when I say chemical dependency. You're used to hearing drug dependency or alcoholism. So I thought it might be beneficial to define a couple terms that I'll be using so that we understand each other. We have the proper tools or words with which to communicate here. I'm going to write a few words on the board. I'd like you to think about the distinction and how you might define it. The first word is ingestion. Drug ingestion. Second word is drug use. Third one is drug misuse, drug abuse, and then finally chemical dependency. Five terms that I'll be using, and I think we have to be clear so that you hear what I'm saying. It's like the story I told you yesterday about Kathy Hansen, those of you that were here. How many weren't here yesterday? Maybe I should repeat. Oh, lots. Let me repeat the story. Because it's applicable and it's kind of fun. Kathy Hansen was a small girl, about 6 years old, and whenever she would meet people, she'd always say, I'm Kathy Hansen, the doctor's daughter, or I'm Dr. Hansen's daughter, Kathy. And she did this all the time, and the mother one night took her aside and said, Kathy, when you meet people, just say you're Kathy or you're Kathy Hansen. You don't have to say you're Dr. Hansen's daughter. You know why she was saying that, right? She wanted to get elevate herself a little bit. Well, it so happened that the next day in school, there's a substitute teacher. And as the substitute looked out over the rows of children, her eyes fell upon Kathy, and she walked over and said, "Aren't you Dr. Hansen's daughter, Kathy?" And the little girl looked up and said, "I always thought I was until last night." And I don't think that's what Mother meant, but that's what Kathy heard. And likewise, I may say some things that I don't really mean, you know, what you're hearing. So this should help. Ingestion. What does ingestion mean?
Taking it in.
It's the physical act. The physical act of taking the mood-altering chemical into your body. There are a number of ways to do it. The most common is through the mouth. You can also sniff it. You can inject it. Some miners down in South Carolina had a rather novel way of doing it. They weren't allowed to bring tobacco into the mines. So they used to put tobacco between their toes. And when they got into the mines, they'd start perspiring, their feet. And through absorption, the nicotine and tobacco would come in to the bloodstream, and they'd get the nicotine into their system that way. Fairly unusual way. But a lot of kids have these bongs that you can spray it in so you don't have the smell of the marijuana on your clothing. There are a number of ways in ingesting it, but it's the physical act. When someone says, "Do you use?" what they're saying, you know, are you ingesting? Okay, use. Now, notice this is kind of a continuum from good to worse. So how would we make the distinction? What might chemical use be? Well, I'll get you started. This is reasonable. Use is reasonable ingestion for legitimate, beneficial purpose. Okay? Use of a mood-altering chemical is reasonable ingestion for legitimate beneficial purpose. What would be some examples?
It's a prescription.
Okay, a prescription. If it says take one tablet every 4 hours and you do that, it's reasonable, it's legitimate, it's going to be beneficial. What did we do Sunday night? We celebrated Eucharist. It was reasonable, legitimate, beneficial. It was part of our ritual, part of our ceremony to take wine. You can take chemicals for medicinal reasons, for ceremony, for ritual, because you're thirsty. Use is not a problem, because as I'm defining it, it's reasonable, legitimate, beneficial. Okay? Misuse then would be what, do you think?
Unreasonable.
Very good. Unreasonable. Unreasonable ingestion. It's no longer necessarily legitimate or beneficial. And the other twist that we add here is that it's potentially harmful to self and others. Okay, so when we move from use to misuse, it's now unreasonable and potentially harmful. Abuse, again, unreasonable. And what's the twist we're going to add here?
It is harmful.
It is harmful. Okay. Abuse, it's unreasonable, it's not legitimate, it's not beneficial, and it is harmful to self and most often to other people. And then chemical dependency, the difference between abuse and chemical dependency is like falling asleep. Last night we all lay down and we fell asleep, but none of us can pinpoint exactly when we fell asleep, right? We woke up in the morning, we realized we fell asleep, but we don't know exactly how or when it happened. It just happened. Slipping from abuse into chemical dependency is like falling asleep. It kind of happens over time. It's very hard sometimes to pinpoint exactly. Okay, are there any questions on the terms here?
Isn't it sort of hard sometimes to define what's reasonable and what's unreasonable?
Yeah.
There may not be consensus, I guess, is what I...
Yeah, it really kind of worries me. Those of you that weren't here yesterday, I really like my shirt.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Be careful.
That's a beautiful
line.
That's CD now.
That's unreasonable right there.
Oh, no.
Anybody been counting?
Yes.
No.
How many?
About 5 spoonfuls.
No, 10, 12 now.
How many would drink this?
Yeah.
I put in 9 teaspoons. This is the number of teaspoons of sugar in a soft drink.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And yet we wouldn't drink this, would we? And yet our kids drink it 3, 4, 5. Well, there are 400... The average for man, woman, and child in the U.S. is 400 cans of soda pop a year. Now, those of us who don't drink any, you can imagine what some people are doing. Okay? Pretty bad. Okay. I don't know. Some people must think it's legitimate, right? All these people are making these soft drinks for us and our children must think that that's legitimate to put 9 teaspoons of sugar in it. If it's a profit, it's legitimate. One thing that I find interesting, of course, getting back to this whole continuum and what is reasonable, what's unreasonable, and the relationship thing, is that our tobacco and alcohol and other industries spend billions of dollars convincing us that we should establish a meaningful relationship with their products. Just a few examples. After a hectic day on the job, relax and enjoy Captain Black. It's a pipe tobacco. See what they're trying to influence us with? Satisfaction, Camel filter style. Some men taste it all. Rich, warm flavor. Smooth, even taste. Solid satisfaction. Nice, trim man, handsome. Drives a masculine-looking vehicle. Pretty lady coming up to him. Relationships. You drink, you smoke Camels, you're going to have these neat relationships with things and people. It's a hidden message, but you see this and hear this enough, and pretty soon it becomes part of what it is to be an adult in this country. Here's another one. Kent, the low tar that won't leave you hungry for taste. Food is a dependency. They want to make the connection between being dependent on Kent for your taste, as well as food for your taste. You've come a long way, baby, Virginia Slims, you know. You kind of have new relationships with men now, women, and you've come a long way, and part of that is to smoke Virginia Slims. That's a sign that you've made it. Some people set their sights higher than others. Notice the rich blue and the black of this one, and the gold. You have to be at a certain level to drink this. Why more dads prefer J&B than any other scotch? Rare taste. America's favorite couple, Seagram 7 and 7-Up. Relationships, couple. And you see, we buy this. These all came on a Sports Illustrated. You look in Time or Newsweek, any magazine, and you're going to get these ads. You watch TV at night from 5:30 to 6:30, the news hour, and you'll see at least 10 commercials telling you to take certain products to make you feel better. Get a good relationship with Anacin or Pepto-Bismol or whatever the product is that they're trying to convince us we need to feel better. Establish that relationship, and they got us. We become dependent on it. And the reason we become dependent on it is why? It works. It works. Very simple. Okay.
Can you tell me again what you were saying about the one about dependency? What were you describing now?
I said it's like falling asleep. There's a fine line between abuse. I suppose you could say if you abused long enough, you would then be defined as chemically dependent. When I use abuse and chemical dependency, I kind of interrelating the terms. And we'll talk a little bit about it on one of the handouts, maybe in terms of the progression. But there is a progression. All of us, I'm sure, have done this. We're all users. Many of us have misused. It might have just been one night. It might have been once a month. It might have been once a year. But all of us have experienced times when we've misused. We've had a little bit too much. Or we had such a splitting headache, we didn't just take two. We decided to take four. That's misuse. Or we're supposed to take these tablets one every 4 hours, and we skipped the whole day because we were too busy. That's misuse. Okay? So we've all misused. And there may be some in here who have abused, or know, certainly all of us know people that have abused. And some of us know people that are chemically dependent. Okay, so these are the tools, the words, the terms that I'll be using, just so we kind of understand one another here. Okay, how do people become chemically dependent?
Is a person who can't start out in the morning without a cup of coffee chemically dependent?
On caffeine.
And is that abuse then?
I would say so.
Is it abuse or dependence? Or both?
Probably both. Yeah, I'm interrelating the terms. Dependence can be of two sorts. It can be psychological, it can be physical. If you wonder whether you're dependent on caffeine in the morning, go a couple days without it and see how your body reacts. Some people go into withdrawal symptoms. Very mild withdrawal symptoms. Okay. Same with sugar. I would bet that most of us in here are dependent on sugar. Try going a couple days without sugar and see the cravings that you feel. Now, you won't go into true withdrawal like some of the harder chemicals, mood-altering chemicals, but you will notice a difference. And if you can stay off it long enough, you'll notice a favorable improvement in terms of your health and well-being. It's just that there's so many hidden sources of sugar that we're all hooked on it. We don't even know it quite often. We consume 125 pounds of sugar, that's the average, 125 pounds of sugar a year. And a lot of it's hidden. Most of us aren't going to put the 9 teaspoons of sugar in our coffee, but we get it in our syrups and fruits and other places. Yeah, same with cigarettes. There are a lot of people that really get hooked on the nicotine. It becomes a physical dependence. And I have a lot of friends that have tried to kick it and really have a hard time. Okay, let's talk then about feelings and how people become chemically dependent. This is called the feelings chart. I gave you copies of it on the chairs. And I'll go through that chart and you know, if anything is unclear, just break in and we'll discuss it as we go along. I think this is a very helpful tool to understand why people become abusers. I put over here the definition of high from the dictionary. And a basic assumption that I have, and those of you that were at Mary Graham's session last night where she talked about we all have a need for the creative person to come out. I think God created us that way. He created us with a desire to get high. It's an instinct, a drive to get high. To be lofty, to be elevated, to exceed the common, to be exalted, to be of great importance, to be elated and merry. This is something we strive after. Does anybody disagree? Okay, we want this in our life. Now, on the feeling chart, it's a continuum from pain or feeling low or feeling down up to joy, euphoria, feeling high. And most of us, most of the time, operate in a fairly normal range of moods. We aren't way down in pain. We aren't way up in extreme joy. We're kind of average, normal people most of the time. Sometimes we experience pain, but it lasts for a short time and we come back into normal range. Sometimes we experience joy, but it wears off and we come back into normal. So most of the time, we spend in here. and I'll put us right there in the middle. But there's a drive within each of us to move to the right, to let that creative self come out, to be high, to be important, to be exalted. And so we learn how we can move to the right. We learn what it takes to move to the right, to feel better, to feel exalted. Now, in non-chemical terms, it could be going on a ski trip, it could be walking on the beach, it could be going to church, it could be coming up to Holden, it could be working on a hobby, it could be having a neat relationship with your children. There are hundreds of ways to get high naturally. The drug question is not, is it right or wrong? It's a question of method. Is using a chemical the right way to get high? Because we're born with a desire to get high. Do you want to do it naturally, which takes effort and time? Anything that's meaningful and important takes time, like growing a garden or establishing a relationship, takes time. Or do you want to do it quickly, with no effort, and just be passive, and then take a chemical? So the drug question is a matter of method. What's the best way to get high? Because believe me, we all need to feel high. Okay, now I'll, keeping that in mind, I'm going to talk mainly about chemical highs. But what I'm saying, you could also flip over and talk about natural ways to get high. Okay, so we learn sometime in our youth that if we take a certain chemical, maybe it's beer with the kids down in the woods, or we snuck some cigarettes from mom's pack and we go down, we know that if we take certain chemicals, something's going to happen. Our mood changes, right? We aren't feeling normal, like normal. Our mood has changed. And generally, maybe the first time you try it, you know, it goes back this way, but if you keep at it, you learn, this is stage one, you learn how to swing your mood towards joy, towards feeling high. And you move out this way then. Okay, you learn the mood swing. You start establishing a relationship with a chemical, whatever it might be. After a period of time, the chemical is oxidized or the effect wears off and you come back to normal. Okay, so you're kind of involved in a very small mood swing. After a period of time, the effect wears off, you come back to normal, no harm. All of us have experienced this. Some would say it's part of growing up. It's part of being a curious, normal, healthy person to experiment and to try out new things. And one thing is to try these chemicals. Why not? Everybody else is doing it. You read the newspaper and there are 10 ads to do it. You look at the news and TV and people are telling us to do it. Why not? I want to try it. Okay, that's what kids say. You do it, why can't we do it? We're curious too. The question is this the right way to get high, kids or grown-ups? A lot of people say, yeah, because this doesn't disappoint me like people do. People disappoint me. People get on my case. People disappoint me. Chemicals don't. Okay. So, we then, after a period of time, move into stage two, which is you start seeking. Seek the mood swing. Normal day, what should we use, an adult or a kid? Let's do both. Kid, end of the school day, Friday, it's been kind of a down week. Here there's a big party going on. Boy, that would be fun to go to. So you start seeking feeling high. You start seeking occasions to get high. And you also start experimenting. That if three beers make you feel that high, what are six beers going to make you feel? Well, it might make you feel way out here. Really giddy, really high, really exalted, really important. And you may try mixing. Let's try a couple pills with some beer. Or let's try some marijuana with some beer and see what effect that has. Wow, go way out here. You're on top of the world. Those lousy teachers, those parents that are on my back, that girlfriend that's going out with someone else, doesn't matter. The only thing that's important is that you're feeling really good. You're feeling high, exalted, on top of the world. And so you start seeking occasions when you can get high, using chemicals now. Remember, you can also do this with people and with things. We're looking at chemicals. After a period of time, the effect wears off, you come back to normal. But boy, was that a fun party. Did I feel good? Okay. Now, most of us in here have probably experienced this. We've looked forward to a party. We've enjoyed ingesting the chemicals that were at the party, and there wasn't any harm done. Okay? So far, there's nothing wrong. There haven't been any problems. But if you start seeking your meaningful relationships in mood-altering chemicals, pretty soon you move into stage three, which is harmful dependency. Now here, and even in stage two, sometimes this happens, that depending upon how much you've used, sometimes you don't settle back in normal. You may have physical pain, like the hangover, the headaches the next morning, maybe you vomited, there may be some physical discomfort, but that eventually wears off, and you say, it was worth it. I mean, I had so much fun last night, this hangover was worth it. And next week, when the weekend comes around again, you don't remember the hangover, you remember the good time at the party. So you again then seek the mood swing. Now in stage three, something very significant happens, and this is what draws the line between reasonable use and occasional misuse into abusing and becoming dependent. This person now is seeking the mood swing quite often, could be every day, certainly every weekend, looking forward to times, maybe every day, every night after work. Why do you stop into the bar? The traffic's so bad, I figure I might as well go in and relax and let the traffic kind of calm down before I come home. And so you stop in the bar every night and you come home feeling relaxed. Or every night before the meal, you got to have a cocktail to unwind, to relax. Okay. You're starting to establish a relationship with a mood-altering chemical, whether you know it or not. You're starting to become dependent on that cocktail before every meal. Now, what happens then is that you maybe have to use more and more, and occasionally, and then more and more often, you don't come back to normal at all. You just bypass normal. You come back here into pain. Now we're talking about emotional pain. You're supposed to be home by 6, and you stopped off to drink, and you didn't come home till midnight. And we were supposed to go over to the Smiths for a party. Okay, now there's some pain, emotional pain, between your spouse and you because of that habit of stopping in and having one drink after work because the traffic's so large. So emotional pain starts happening. Now by this time, the relationship with the mood-altering chemical is very important, as we talked about yesterday. And so the person starts building defenses, rationalizations around himself. He starts building a wall of defenses to justify using, ingesting. Because this is now becoming the most important relationship in his or her life. More important than the family, the spouse, or the work. And so it's very hard for this person to see what he's doing. Because he can rationalize anything. He can justify anything. He has euphoric recall. He doesn't remember the bad times. He only remembers the good times. He has blackouts. So it's very hard for him to get out and see reality because he's built a wall around himself. Likewise, it's very hard for you or me or anybody else to get in because he doesn't want us to come in. He doesn't want anybody to interfere with his love relationship with Matt. So he can't get out, we can't get in, and if we just let that go on, he's going to die. No question about it. Alcoholism is a disease, it's fatal, and if we let this person live in pain long enough, he will die. Alcoholism is 100% fatal. And tomorrow we're going to do an intervention. In fact, if any of you would like to help me out with it, I'd like to role play an intervention. Someone that is chemically dependent will have a client, and I'd like 5 to 8 people that will just read 1 or 2 sentences, and we'll role play an intervention so you can see what it takes to break through this wall to get that person help. Because if you don't get them help, what's going to happen? He dies. And what often happens is that the family gets sucked right into the same wall of defenses. And you have a family system, and the whole family gets sick. The wife becomes an enabler. She starts making excuses for her husband. He's passed out on the couch. Someone calls. Is Joe home? No, he's out. He's in, but he is out. Okay? A friend calls, can you come over to party tonight? No, we'd better not. The reason is that the last party they went to, he made such a fool out of himself and broke glasses that she doesn't want to embarrass herself or her family. The husband, or the wife, the dependent person is overdrawn in the checking account, so the spouse will take money out of his or her account, put in his, so that that is an embarrassment to the family. Okay, so the wife or the spouse is getting sucked into this whole disease, and she becomes an enabler and allows, and she does it out of love, you know, but she allows the person to sink lower and lower, and she becomes codependent. And the kids, they don't invite friends over because dad might be drinking. They get very much part of the disease too. And alcoholism is a family disease. For every alcoholic, there are 5 others affected.
You might want to answer this later on. I'm not sure. It might be getting into something more. But my father's an alcoholic, and I've always wondered, I've been in this whole enabling thing and know a lot about the whole chemical dependency chain, and always wondered, well, how do you break the chain? Do you have to get pulled down with it in order to break the chain?
No.
Well, then how can you stop as far as enabling? You do things like don't ask friends over, okay? That was a good example. I don't want my friends to see my father when he's drunk.
Sure.
Or when he's, verbally abusing our family. So I don't bring them over.
Yeah, and so it continues. The Johnson Institute, where I was trained, and they've done a lot of interventions, say the only way to break into this person's reality is to allow crises to happen. We got to stop making excuses and alibis for the alcoholic. Now, a lot of times, we wait till the alcoholic hits bottom, and then we have a tremendous medical establishment and treatment facilities to try to put this person back together again. And we're all very good ambulance drivers. That once someone is stumbling around drunk, and there's no question about it, he needs help or he's going to die tomorrow, then we come in and we pick up the pieces and put him in treatment and fix him up. And people say, no, that's wrong. Put a gate up here. So we're going to get in tomorrow, prevention and intervention. Why wait till an alcoholic hits rock bottom before you do something about it?
But isn't the whole idea of, shouldn't it be that the alcoholic wants treatment?
No. An alcoholic never wants treatment.
But if you put them in treatment, I mean, my father's been through hundreds of different treatment centers, literally, and that almost seems to me an enabling situation where we're putting him in there, so we're the ones that are doing it. He's not making the choice, and therefore the programs are never
right.
Usually
okay.
Successful.
That's why we get back here. You have to break into his reality and make him aware of what's happening. Yeah, you say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And, you know, you're raising the key issue in this whole field, when to intervene, when to confront. And if a person is truly chemically dependent, the defenses and rationalizations are so good that they don't realize they're an alcoholic. They don't want to hear you, and they make you feel bad. And they have 100 ways to get around it. And so, as we'll role play tomorrow in the intervention, you have to confront them with specific, concrete data of what they're doing. And if it's done well, you can get into their walls and make them see what they've become, because you care about them and love them. Now, if you can't get into those walls, and a treatment center can't get into those walls, right, they aren't going to, you know, the relationship with Mac is more important than you or your mother or anybody. And that's what it comes down to. The chemical is more important than you are, his daughter, you know, in blunt terms.
Mm-hmm. Along with this realization and maybe the desire to have a treatment, they have to have a goal of some sort of safety that they can go forward to so that they won't fall back on alcohol.
Treatment is 10% of recovery, 90% occurs after. And most treatment facilities use an AA approach. First step in AA is what? Anybody know?
Admit
what you are, that you're powerless and you need help from God or the higher power. Once you can admit you're powerless over this mood-altering chemical and you need help, then you can work from there. And there are 12 steps in AA. And if you can't admit that, if he can't admit that he's powerless and needs help, yeah, he's just going to roll, you know, play his game through treatment, and because he knows he's going to get out. If he's gone through it 100 times, that's 101.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, keep trying, because maybe sometime the right person will say the right thing at the right moment in history, and it'll get through to them, you know. And what people find is that it usually takes a crisis. It takes a death, or a firing from a job, or the wife walking out, or it takes some crisis. And if you can combine or group a number of crises within a short period of time, maybe you can crash into his reality.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you keep covering up and enabling and letting these little, kind of smoothing out the problems, that's just what he wants.
Yeah. Well, it's sad because, you know, crises have happened for so many years that it's hard. I'm the youngest of four children to see the history even before I was born and still see it happening. And no matter how many crises we seem to go through, you know, it doesn't. There never seems, that key just never seems
have
to
you, I suppose you have. Have you had a professional counselor work with the family and do an intervention with him?
Yeah.
Okay.
The crisis that I was just going to mention is also an illness or an accident that isn't, you know, I mean, it's not like necessarily the person's going into DTs or that they can't function, but let's say that they have a stomach ulcer or they have some other, you know, direct physical complaint, which is really, that's the source of it. I think a lot of times we overlook that. Or if a person hurts themselves, we treat the hurt, the broken bone, the whatever it is, because we're feeling sorry for them. Whereas that's that issue. I was a little confused between the misuse and abuse in terms of being harmful. You know, the person who's misusing and then happens to harm himself during the, you know, while he's under the misuse, is that then abuse truly isn't?
Yeah,
I mean, it's a fine line.
Yeah, it is a fine line. And let me explain, maybe this would be helpful for others, that the stages here, the progression, goes something like this. We all start out abstainers in life, although they are saying that some people whose mother is an alcoholic are born alcoholics. They have that physical dependence even while they're in the womb.
Drugs. The child can be born.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, blue, addicted.
Yeah.
Rick, yes, exactly. Well, anyway, there are different stages, and we can talk about the ones that we just went over, the feeling chart, learning, seeking, harmful dependence in the chronic stage, or we could look at in terms of motivation. The motivation to ingest initially is pleasure, well, stage one. In two, the motivation to ingest is relief. In stage three, it's maintenance. And in stage four, it's escape to oblivion. We all start out learning and seeking the mood swing, and it's pleasurable. It helps us get high. It feels good. And so we use. Possibly, then we might move into stage two, which is to use for relief at the end of the day, at the end of a hard week at school. The motivation has switched from pleasure to relief for any discomfort or any pain or whatever we're feeling. Now notice, this didn't just go boom, boom, did it? It kind of occurs over time, and even people that are using for relief, once in a while, they feel guilty about it, or they don't need it. They can go a month or two and just use with pleasure, for pleasure. But if they get caught up in this is, I'm showing you the classic example, the classic slide now. Okay, and if they're in relief for a while, maybe they'll come up there again, but then they're down in maintenance, once in a while up. Okay, get the pattern?
Can you stop at maintenance and not get down into the escape?
You can stop anywhere. But you know, I've worked 10 years with adolescents. And the hardest part with adolescents is that all they see from using is this. They don't see any of the pain or the hurt that often older people have experienced. Getting fired, losing a spouse, all the fights at home. They just see the fun. You get back into this crisis. You know,
I guess I just have a question. I had really bad back trouble, and I went to my family doctor, and he said, I rebelled against that because I didn't want to do that. But I was just wondering, you know, maybe that would be good advice for some people, but for me, I chose not to do that. What's your opinion on that?
Do the right thing. Has it gone away?
Well, it comes and goes.
That's the difference between a chemical versus a natural means of healing. I mean, it's not much difference between taking a glass of wine every day or taking a pill every day. I mean, you're still going to get physically dependent. That happens a lot of times.
You know how many people are dependent on Valium?
Yeah.
30 million. 30 million people dependent. It's the most prescribed pill today.
I was just addicted to that. I mean, I used that because at one time in my life, I was married, went away from home for the first time. Yeah, I'm still married. And had a little baby within a year. And that hit me hard. And I went and they gave me Valium because I couldn't explain all these weird feelings, not being able to sleep. And it took me 3 years. Finally, well, after taking 4 pills a day, I finally went and got some help. And it never did, you know. I mean, I got accustomed to so much and would take a little more. It never did go away, let it go, and then I'd have awful depression. And so finally, I realized that, like your backache, I have those myself. The depression, whatever else, I had to find a solution to what was going on. I had to find out where that really was at.
Yeah.
And then my symptoms would go away. But it took a long, long time.
I think, what can you do far as, you know, to release the release stage, whether it's you come from home from work and you take a drink to unwind. My thing was, you know, having a glass of wine at 5 in the afternoon while I was trying to fix dinner and the kids were young. And I finally, you know, realized what it was, and I didn't want to do that every day. But what, I mean, there are periods of your life where maybe you do have tension or something. And what are some good ways of relieving that that's not just...
They missed it last week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, last week the topic that we dealt with was Christian lifestyle and age of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And the whole week was on health from a holistic perspective. Mm-hmm. And two days we dealt with stress and relaxation techniques, fitness, different ways that you can relieve the tension that's building up within you in natural, normal, healthy ways that make you feel better. Because see, the catch-22 in chemicals is that while it does make you feel better initially, what happens? Makes you feel worse in the end. It's positively negative. You see? Yeah.
I heard a glimpse of a conversation, and I don't know if that's... And I wasn't trying to bet, but it might fit in. What I heard was that the addiction to jogging, what that is truly an addiction, because there's a natural morphine that becomes developed in that. And that, and I've noticed since I've been jogging, it's like it really is an addiction.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go back to that.
Well, at least it's helpful.
Well, if you build up a natural morphine within you, you'd like to produce.
No, I know. Your own endorphins.
Okay.
Let me say something on that, because I think it's very significant and it might help. It's true. It's the same process. You learn that chemicals or jogging make you feel better. Okay? You start seeking it. And initially, maybe you're just jogging once or twice a week. Later on, it's three or four times. Maybe eventually you're jogging five, 6 days a week. Why? Because it makes you feel high. All these things happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay? And, in fact, you become dependent on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the difference between that kind of dependency and addiction, and it is, and chemical addiction and dependency, I think, is very significant. On the one hand, think about how you get your pleasure. With jogging, it's active. You're involved in it. You're doing something to get your pleasure, right? How do you get your pleasure with a chemical? You don't do anything. You're passive. Okay, so one thing, active pleasure, I think, is very significant. Another thing, the results. In the one hand, the jogging can enrich your life, make you feel better as a person. With the chemicals, the dependency deteriorates your life in all areas. Jogging can enrich you physically, spiritually, mentally, socially, and emotionally, and it does with many people. Chemical dependency will deteriorate you physically, mentally, socially, spiritually, and emotionally. No question about it. Now, jogging only becomes a problem if, on your relationship map, if you're jogging 3 hours every morning and 3 hours afternoon, so you're not spending any time with your family. If you can fit a positive addiction into your lifestyle so that you don't deteriorate your other relationships with people and with things, then it's helpful and it's good. It's only people that carry it to the extreme and they don't want to be around people because it interferes with their jogging. That's what makes it harmful. Not that it's deteriorating the body or any of these other things. Do you all see the distinction between it? And it doesn't have to be jogging. It could be anything that makes you feel good can become a positive addiction. And in working with kids, working with anybody, that's the thing. Is a chemical the best way to get high? And if we can't answer that question, then they're going to use chemicals. Because it works. You can't start getting a jogging high till you've been running for long, many, many miles. And there's a lot of pain before you get to that euphoric feeling.
It's also self-regulating.
Yeah.
You can't jog forever. You can't overdose on it, really.
That's right. And if you go 3-4 days, it's almost like starting over. You really got, okay, with a chemical, you don't have any of those problems.
Yeah.
You know, it works every time. It's simple. It never disappoints you. And it's painless. It's much easier just go gulp down some martinis than to go out and run 5 miles. Okay? Same effect, you think. But the one enriches and the one deteriorates. Very important distinction. Yes.
What truth is there in the theory that children will inherit the tendency to be alcoholic?
Inherit a tendency?
Yeah. Is there truly a tendency?
I'm not sure what I believe with that. I've seen chemical dependency come out of all sorts of backgrounds and homes, good homes, quote, and bad homes, homes with alcoholic parents, homes where they're abstainers. It's a disease that can affect anybody. The conclusion that some people say is that there's an X factor, and that's that mysterious element that they don't know whether some people are more prone to become. And we have found that I guess you take 3 people and they all experience a divorce, and all 3 will start drinking heavily to drown their sorrows. One will become alcoholic, the other 2 won't. Same set of situations. Why does the one become alcoholic and the other 2 don't? X factor. Now, some people even say it's because some people are addicted to sugar, and it's the sugar and the alcohol that they crave. And the same with nicotine. Our tobacco in this country is cured with sugar. And a lot of people, it's the sugar within the nicotine that is the addicting element.
What about sugar addiction? I don't know, but I would guess probably everybody is addicted to sugar. I think I surely am. Everybody laughs at that. Or is there any kind of serious health to that?
In some ways, I think sugar is the biggest health hazard in the country today.
Yeah, but I mean, nobody really, everybody laughs. I mean, you eat cookies, you eat, go to someone's house and you can't have a cup of coffee without having some coffee cake. It's just kind of, it's like rejecting a relationship if you don't sit down and ask them to eat with them.
Alcohol, nicotine, caffeine, sugar are all accepted mood-altering chemicals in this country. No one gets all that uptight about it, unless their kids using it. Drugs, pot, that's a little scary for us, older people. But sugar, caffeine, and nicotine, you know, that's not that big a deal.
But
it is true. Sugar Blues by William Duffy. When you take sugar into your system, it gives you a sudden high, but the sugar, the refined sugar, is not usable by the body. And so we have to break down that sugar, and that takes more of our stored sugar. And so after 1 or 2 hours, we actually become depressed. We get sugar blues. We feel worse than we did before. That's why a lot of people get very tired about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Because they've had a big lunch, or they've had some sugar snack, and they feel real good for a little bit, but then the whole body just reacts to all that sugar that you had in your system. Hyperactivity has been associated with sugar among children. A lot of the kids, they're very hyper now because for morning they have their Twinkies and a can of Coke. And at noon they have some potato chips and chocolate cake and a can of Coke. And boy, they're just flying around in the afternoon.
Then how do you avoid all of the sugar? Because it's in Campbell's soup, it's in our ketchup, it's everywhere. And a couple weeks ago I was told that honey isn't any better for you than sugar. And yet a lot of people can't eat their oatmeal without sugar. Unless you put raisins or something, it's so hard to get away from it.
Yeah, it is. You have to cut back and just eliminate. Be alert, be aware. Sugar are empty calories. they're of no nutritional value. And sugar, of course, is related to obesity and other health, you know, elevated blood pressure and other problems. I guess it's just a matter of trying to cut back. You know, if you're making, baking things, cut the sugar in half or substitute honey and cut that in half. That's what we've done in our home. Instead of buying the commercial soups, get into making homemade soups. You have, in a way, it's kind of like David fighting Goliath. I mean, I like to look at this, the tobacco and the alcohol and these industries as being the Goliath out there. And my not going in and buying soda pop and you know, the different things we're doing is a way of trying to slay these people that are keeping us sick.
Sometimes it takes the crisis in that area just as it does for the alcoholic to bring people to realization. I've seen some families, and because of their problems, I think has influenced, you know, somewhat the way some of the rest of us have responded in the church. Instead of cookies and Kool-Aid for Bible school, they switched their whole tactic just this year and decided that other things were more beneficial for all concerned, the teachers dealing with these children. And if in one family particularly, because the child had this, it was a really severe problem for him in his schooling and at home and everything, the entire family decided if it's good for him to eat this way, then it's good for all of us. And they had to do a lot of research, and they weren't, you know, university people or anything. They were a farm family.
Yeah.
But they had to revise their whole tactic of foods.
It's time to quit. Let me just read this positively negative, and then I'll stay around if you have any questions, because I think this ties together in a neat little knot what I've been talking about. We drank for happiness and became unhappy. We drank for joy and became miserable. We drank for sociability, became argumentative. We drank for sophistication, became obnoxious. We drank for friendship and made enemies. We drank for sleep and awakened without rest. We drank for strength and felt weak. We drank medicinally and acquired health problems. We drank for relaxation and got the shakes. We drank for bravery and became afraid. We drank for confidence and became doubtful. We drank to make conversation easier and slurred our speech. We drank to feel heavenly and ended up feeling like hell. We drank to forget and were forever haunted. We drank for freedom and became slaves. We drank to erase problems and saw them multiply. We drank to cope with life and invited death. Okay, in closing, positively negative. That's the catch-22 in using chemicals as we become dependent.